Hello, everyone. My name is Tim. Welcome to All Out Coach. My friends, listeners, All Out Coach is your collection of stories, of secrets and techniques that unveil some of the most deeply rooted questions that we seek, but we do not always ask, or some of the answers that we do not always provide to others as well. With All Out Coach, my intention is to inspire more of you to stretch yourselves and lift others, because I believe that all of us have a duty to create our own legacy in life and also other leaders in the future, regardless of how much we have accomplished in the past. So I enjoy some of the guests and some of the discussions, many of whom I call Renaissance men and women. And I look forward to the renaissance of new ideas in 2021. Today, I'm particularly excited because I have a Renaissance man of his own, Zach Mercurio, who's able to seamlessly integrate many aspects of wisdom and truth and questions in life into the business world. So he's studied the organizational development, organizational cultures, and we share a huge passion for company cultures. Zach Mercurio, an award-winning researcher, affiliate professor, instructor, and speaker, keynote speaker, who's going to discuss with us purpose-driven leadership and company culture. Zach, welcome. Welcome to All Out Coach. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Tim. I'm excited to be here.
Likewise. It's the first episode of the year. And I'd like to ask you first to think about some of those moments in your life, some of the most memorable moments, stitch them together and explain to us how they have shaped Zach Mercurio, the bright leader who transforms people and companies. What are some of those moments that you can take us through?
Yeah, I think for me, it goes back to just growing up. You know, I was the youngest of three brothers in an Italian family in New England. And when you're the youngest, you get really good at entertaining yourself and comparing yourself to other people, like trying to measure up, right, to the older brothers. And so for me in my own life, there was always this kind of search for significance, right? I was always trying to search for enough, trying to search to prove myself. And what I realized is as I went through college and I got my first job, is that really acquiring and achieving things would never satisfy me. I realized that very early on. And I was in a first job out of college. I was in advertising and I was doing well. You know, on the outside, everybody thought that I was successful, but on the inside, I was miserable. And it wasn't because of the job. There's many people who find incredible purpose in advertising. It was because I was going out, I was in sales, I was talking to human beings who needed what we had, and I would go back to the office, and every time I would sit in on a meeting, we'd talk about those human beings as, what can we get out of them? How can we make more money out of them? They were targets, they were quotas, they were sales goals. And that disconnect was so real for me. And I said, you know, I just can't do this. I can't do this anymore. You know, there's no reason for the business to exist unless it is for the value of these human beings. And I remember during that time that I was sort of like soul searching, I met a lot of people like bus drivers, cab drivers, people who do ordinary work, but they have an extraordinary perspective. I mean, and that's one thing I've really learned is that the most extraordinary people do ordinary work with an extraordinary perspective. And most of those people who are just joyous, they don't focus on what they do or what they can get for what they do. They tend to focus on the contribution that they make through what they do. And that was something that I wanted. You know, I was like, how do I get that? How do I learn how to create that? And then how do I learn how to create organizations so that no one has to work in an organization that I worked in? And that really spurred my career over really the last decade on researching and studying how we come to experience meaningfulness in the places where we spend almost 35% of our waking lives at work.
Yeah, you spent time at Colorado State University where you teach.
Yeah.
Direct at Tell us a little bit about some of the inspiration behind that research. Are they inspired by Simon Sinek? I'm reading the Infinite Game
book. Yeah.
Are there particular people that also contributed to leading you towards that direction?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Simon. Let's start with why, right? In 2009, he made this idea of purpose that's very primitive. This idea that we need a why, need a contribution. He made it mainstream. Yeah. Brought it back into mainstream consciousness, which at the very same time, I was doing a lot of work on purpose and meaningfulness and training people by not teaching them what to do or how to do it, but by showing them the impact that the work makes. Making sure people know the significance of a task before they know how to do a task, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it sounds very simple, but it's just this reverse engineering of how, you know, business and work had evolved up to that point. So yeah, he made some of these ideas of purpose very mainstream. But what's more striking to me than anything about some of his TED Talks is the sheer amount of viewers that it got. Right. This simple idea of starting with why got millions and millions of viewers. And why is that? I think it's because of the deep hunger that people all over the world have for more meaning in their lives. I don't know if you've heard of the book Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes.
Viktor Frankl was a concentration camp survivor. He was also a psychiatrist by trade. And in the foreword of his book, where he talks about the search for meaning in that horrific condition of being in that camp, he says that he wishes his book was not a bestseller. Because if a book called Man's Search for Meaning is a bestseller, it means there's an unsatisfied search for meaning out there, right?
Yeah.
And now you look at it, right? If you put a blog post up with Find Your Purpose or Find Your Meaning, you'll get a lot of reads. So I think it goes back to what influenced me really was around me. I saw that search for meaningfulness. One of my first studies at Colorado State was with a group of janitors and how people on the front line come to experience meaningfulness. Now, why did I start there? Well, there was one moment where I was walking through the hallways of a lecture hall and I was going to a professional development conference. And one of the janitors who I knew, you know, said, hi, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to this professional development class. And she said, oh, well, how did you hear about that? I said, it was in my email. And I said, have you heard about these classes? And she said, I've been at this university for over 15 years and nobody ever told me I had an email address. And I realized like that these frontline workers who make up millions of our jobs and organizations, there was some sort of gap in that experience of meaningfulness. And so that was one of my first studies. So it's really about just that general search for meaning that I saw all around me inspired me to do my work.
The next generation of leaders, they're really looking for a purpose. It's clear. And I think it's a testament to the intelligence of the next generation and the hope we should have, which probably I would venture to guess maybe decades ago, just was not at the top of the mind of most CEOs and some of the Fortune 500 companies to create meaning for their employees, where now it's becoming more mainstream, to your point. Since we both like culture, I'd like to ask you what some of your favorite definitions of culture, company culture are, as well as or deconstruction of company culture, of the elements of company culture.
My favorite is going back to Edgar Schein's culture work. If anybody's not familiar with Edgar Schein, he's a foremost scholar of organizational culture, but it's a very simple model. And it's some of the most cliche models are the most accurate because it's the iceberg model. At the top, you have artifacts. These are the things people can see. You can, the signs on the walls, the values on the walls, the behaviors. Any behavior is a mere symptom of the underlying culture. So those are artifacts at the top. The middle level is your stated values, what you say you believe in, what you say guides your decisions and your actions and your behaviors, what you say guides your artifacts.
Yeah.
But then beneath the surface, which are the most powerful, are the underlying beliefs. These are the things that people assume to be true. And almost always the beliefs guide culture. It's very hard to change a culture if you just change behaviors without changing the beliefs that created the behaviors in the first place. So a belief is like a shared truth. Like I came into my office today, I sat down in a chair because I believe that chairs are for sitting in. I didn't come into my office today and say, is that chair, is that structure for sitting in, right? Because that would sound ridiculous. That's how embedded shared truths are in your organization. Those beliefs are there. The key is to ask questions that uncover those beliefs and change those beliefs. And so when you look at beliefs, values, artifacts, that's a good way of thinking about it. But then also there are, you asked me what culture was, what the components are of a positive culture are, we know that there are four things really that create positive cultures. The first is that people regularly experience meaningfulness. They know that they matter and how they matter. The second is that they experience more positive emotions than negative emotions. So it's positive. The third is that it's connected. So they experience high quality connections and relationships. And the fourth is that they can do those things in a fear-free environment, and an environment that's free of fear, free of fear of retribution for coming up with new ideas, for giving feedback. So meaningful, positive, connected, and fear-free. And so that's how I like to think about culture, because it helps us not only to think about what culture is, but helps us to think about what a positive culture is. And there's a difference.
You and I have spoken before, Zach, and I shared with you some of my frustration with some of our jargon, corporate jargon, business jargon, which also I think becomes part of our underlying beliefs as well, that culture is something that's static. For example, I've never used or liked the phrase culture fit. You know, when you hire somebody,
right?
Because culture fit kind of implies to me something, a culture that is static. So I look at culture, even the word culture, as something that's dynamic, that needs to be nourished from time to time. Just like when you culture yogurt, for example, right? Or bacteria on a plate, right? From a scientific experiment, you need to culture so that it grows. So I know that you have many different clients that you advise, that you transform. And so, you know, what are some of the driving factors that make a culture work or not work in a company from your experiences?
Yeah. So the biggest downfall that I see is companies try to prescribe culture. If you have to tell someone this is our culture, it's not your culture. You know, the best medicine tastes like poison when we're forced to take it, right? So culture, like you said, is not prescriptive. Culture is generative. Mm-hmm. So there's this is a really interesting difference to think about if you're a leader listening. Are you prescribing something or are you generating it from within? So generating culture means deeply understanding people's beliefs, what they believe about the work, how they communicate, who they communicate with, how they feel already. Yeah. You can't change a culture by saying, this is our new culture. That just creates a lot of dissonance. And so I find that that's a big downfall, is trying to prescribe culture without understanding culture at the deep, like frontline level. Yeah. But the things that are working really well are when people start and organizations start to think about culture as robustly as they think about their financial strategy. Like they actually start architecting and planning culture. What are the dimensions of culture? One of the best tools that I've seen used is what I've been calling a culture blueprint, where you take your purpose, you take your mission, and then you say, well, if we were to believe in those things, what would we believe? What would our values have to be to bring those beliefs into actions? How would we communicate each other? With each other, when, where, how will we communicate? How will we approach our work tasks? So what's our approach? Before we even do a kit task, how are we thinking about it here? How do we reward people? How do people learn the culture? And when you create a culture blueprint, that's like a business plan for your culture. And then you start measuring against that culture that's generative. That's where the magic happens, I see, in organizations. And that's a process, and it takes time. And it takes talking to people about what they believe, what they value, what they actually value when they're at their best. What are they thinking about when they are most engaged? How are they thinking about their work, and taking that data and turning it into your idealized culture?
So company culture has the kinds of opponents to it, and from my experiences, who think, look, it has to grow organically. You know, let it grow, grow. We're too small. They have an association that company culture initiative only works to benefit larger companies. This is something company culture discussion only belongs in a large corporation. And I've seen those same people actually make the culture so impossible to work in environments where you kind of wonder, oh, that's, you know, as a person who supports it and who is in the position to drive a culture in some direction, you realize that, look, no wonder this person was really against it because they didn't really believe in its value. They don't have an updated view of company culture. The size, the status quo, look, we're good. We're doing well. We communicate well in my company, right? We don't need to change our culture. So as yet they continue to undermine their colleagues, right? Or to behave in such a way that is not acceptable. And that's why one of the very short definitions that I've also liked is that culture is the worst behavior that a company is willing to tolerate. Do you think that there is a threshold of how large a company has to be before it needs to look internally to, you know, change a culture or to actually address its culture? Who have you seen address it well?
I mean, can you imagine having a friendship with zero shared expectations for how you'd behave with one another? You wouldn't have many friends,
right?
So it's the same. We take these like business concepts and we dehumanize them, right? I mean, you would never stay friends with somebody where there wasn't a norm to treat each other with respect, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yet business leaders want to create companies where there's no norms to treat each other with respect, and they expect people are going to stay.
Right.
To me, it's crazy, actually. I'm going to be honest with you. Yeah. And one of the things with culture is that if there's more than one human being present in a room, there's culture.
I agree with you.
I mean, and so, and first of all, let me tell you, I'm fine if you want to say, well, I'll just let the culture develop.
Right.
That's fine with me. If you want to say like, I'll let the culture develop, you know, I'm not going to stand for anything. There's not going to be a good way of communicating here. We'll just let it develop. That's fine. I don't think you'll be around for too long in the long haul, because what inevitably happens is that if you let a culture just organically develop, your reward system then takes over. So if you just incentivize performance and don't incentivize helpfulness or incentivize respect or incentivize contribution, then what you'll get is a series of high performers that are competing with one another for their own survival. And the culture will eat itself over time. You see that with Wells Fargo. You see that with Boeing. You see that with all of these different companies who have had tragic outcomes of a culture that was allowed to happen where goals and rewards superseded values and behaviors. And so, you know, and the way I see it is sometimes when you're in a small company and you're a leader, culture can be intuitive, right? It's like I work with a good amount of startups, right? They go from 3 people to 10 people to 20 people. And I find when you have 3 or 4 people, it's intuitive, right? It's controllable. If something's going wrong, you can kind of, you know, course correct. But if you get up to 8 or 10 people, you become kind of like a teenager a little bit, right? And where you're kind of thrashing about and the teenager can talk back a little bit and you start losing some control. And then all of a sudden the culture grows and you've lost control. And the other thing I would say that to go back to some opposition of culture is if you can name one financial result or performance outcome that is not mediated through a human being, I'll pay you a lot of money. Right? Every result that you care about, every performance outcome is mediated through a human being. And the big question to ask yourself, how do I want those human beings to feel? What would a human being who produces that outcome feel like? How would they think about their work? How would they think about each other? Because these things aren't opposites. It's not culture or performance. It's culture for performance and performance because of culture.
Right. And that's not an easy concept to really teach and to instill in people who are in this information overload and in this business world that's ever so volatile these days.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah.
But it's a necessary one. It's kind of like the operating system of the company. Yeah, I agree. You need a culture in any friendship, with even if when you have one friend, one a meeting, in a marriage with a significant other, you need to set some kind of norms of engagement. Otherwise, you know, for because if you have a long-term outlook, right?
Right.
So there is a generational gap, I think, also that exists in our perceptions of company culture. I felt this particularly when I went back to my alma mater, where I had graduated 15 years ago, and I gave them a keynote on next generation leadership. I already knew that in that 15 years, this team was highly polished, but had grown much faster, much bigger than my class, you know, when I was graduating with a fellowship in the pharmaceutical industry. But I purposely make sure to connect with the next generation, Zach, in order to understand, to keep my hands on the pulse of purpose and of what, you know, what needs they have, what ideas they have. And, you know, even this podcast, the fact that I started this podcast, I owe the idea to a mentee, somebody that I was mentoring, that was solving problems of his company internally through a podcast in innovative ways. So how do we resist this generational gap that exists still? Because I think there are, one of the reasons why people do not find purpose is because you have a lot of people still in power, you know, who are used to tolerating those worst behaviors quietly, to your points about Boeing and Wells Fargo, for years, right? For decades. Yet they still have the main power and they still maintain that foothold, stronghold, you know? So how do we teach and educate, you know, the generations in order to really bridge that gap somehow?
Yeah, well, I think we need to be sure that a gap really exists. So, and what I mean by that is that it's having empathy, right? I mean, I have a lot of empathy for leaders who wake up every day and their worth is determined by a quarterly earnings report. Right? I mean, if you wake up every day and your sense of self-worth is tied to what you do and what you get for what you do, it's not surprising that over time, one would become hyper-obsessed with performance over just about everything else, right? So I think we have to approach these situations with a lot of empathy there. But I also then think we have to bridge this gap by looking at shared truths, right? So if I were to ask a group of baby boomers, Gen Z, I don't know, what are they now? Millennial, Gen Z. Yeah, and if I were to ask everybody in a room, if I were to ask everybody in a room, right, how many of you all would prefer not to feel a sense of meaning in their work? No one would raise their hand and say, I've done this. No one raises their hand and say, oh yeah, I prefer not, right? I mean, we all have that innate desire for meaningfulness. And in fact, purpose and meaning, for example, those are not generational trends. Those are basic human desires. You go back to the second industrial revolution, MLA Durkheim, he was a sociologist, and he did research on what caused the rash of suicides after the second industrial revolution. And what he found was that it wasn't the loss of money from not working. It was the loss of a sense of contribution, of purpose. If you go back to the Great Depression, it wasn't just the loss of money that was causing mental distress. It was the loss of the ability to feel useful and like you had worth in society. If you look at the Great Recession, that the job insecurity that resulted in four times more visits to mental health facilities after the recession for people who kept their jobs was a result of fear of feeling worthless, feeling useless, right? Worth, feeling worth, feeling useful, feeling like you have a contribution, that's purpose. That's meaningfulness. So across generations, we find in worldwide research that the need for meaningfulness is the same across generations. In fact, in the meaningful work research, we find no difference in generations. What we do find is the ability to talk about it is different.
Right. Yeah.
So like the younger generation grew up with stories from around the world on their phone, you know? So like my generation, if you didn't like your job, you could talk about it to millions of people. Whereas in other generations, if you didn't like your job, you went home and told the same two people every day.
Yeah.
So it's a different, our span of ideas and knowledge about alternatives is wider because of technology. And so we're able to have these conversations more. So one of the things that I think we need to do is have some conversations about shared truths. I mean, ask some of the people that we think are old school, you know, where do they find meaning in their work? How would they want their kids to feel at work? And those types of, I think, dialogues that get at these universal truths are really powerful and important.
Great comments. I really enjoyed your distinction, which I think is important, that, you know, many people kind of tend to categorize deaf generations in different buckets, but, you know, ultimately we're all human. And I often also say, Zach, that regardless of our age, our background, our status, our role, we all seek attention and recognition or importance.
Yeah.
Whether or not, you know, we have grandkids, we all want, or children, right? At all stages of our life. So I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. But, and also on that second point that you made, that it just wasn't talked about. Because I remember, I grew up, for example, in a family of professors and physicians, so teachers, physicians, mm-hmm. the healthcare industry on one side of the family, the other side was more business oriented. For me, teacher was an authority, a professor. I wouldn't question, even if
yeah.
when I was in pharmacy school, for example, when I had a professor who wasn't maybe justified in some assignments or how they approach tests, I was not the first person, like many others, who would complain. You know, I would just try to deal with it and try to work around it, find some other resources, go somewhere else, network. And when I taught this next generation, I noticed just how much more demanding they were and how much impatient they are. You know, whereas nowadays, people are graduating with their MBA, but then they want to be their own CEO and entrepreneur. So, you know, I don't think that a society in which no one is an independent thinker is healthy in the same way that I don't think that a society in which everyone wants to be an entrepreneur either. I think you have to go through some trials and tribulations and have some patience and flexibility. So it's, to me, it's a spectrum. The technology increases our exposure, I think, you know, and we're being more heard, you know, you have more social responsibility, social consciousness that I really like. So I'm really, you know, hopeful for what the next generation is going to do, I think, in the future as well. To me, just being able to talk about it and bring different stakeholders together so that they can relate back to your point, the purpose, and I think close these gaps that continue to exist. I want to ask you a question about the hiring practice also. You know, how up to date is our hiring system in the corporate world today? You know, are we ready to take on these new next generation, you know, leaders out there who may not have, let's say, 10 years of experience fulfilling a particular role and who get left behind because they don't fit some kind of computer algorithm in HR that still continues to exist in many of these companies, right? So if I want to ask you to take the hat of a young, like ambitious, accomplished, professional who has the character, who has the behavior, who has the purpose and right intentions, but is not able to make that next step.
I mean, what I've seen is it's been all over the place, to be honest with you, depending on organization. A lot of it is organization specific. But one of the warnings that I have is that we've gone into this big idea of skills-based hiring, right? And one of the problems with just hiring for skills is that when you have skills, but you don't have the energy to use those skills, the skills are useless. So what I mean by that is that, you know, what I see in higher education is after the recession, there was sort of a knee-jerk reaction. Everybody was then questioning the value of higher education, for example. And so the knee-jerk reaction from higher education was, oh, we need to prepare people for jobs. But what inevitably started happening is you were preparing spiritless specialists. You were giving people all of these technical skills without the human skills to cultivate the energy and the motivation and the mindset to be able to use those skills. So talents without passion are useless. Passion without talent, energy without skill is useless. Both together, with knowing that the problems you want to solve with those strengths and talents are passions and talents are where I think we need to be cultivating talent from. So when it comes to hiring, you know, I think the best organizations make sure to have measures in place that both measure energy for learning, motivation for learning, and skill, not just skill and technical ability. Because what you don't want is you do not want an organization filled with spiritless specialists, or you'll be spending millions of dollars every year replacing them with more spiritless specialists, right? So I think that that's something that needs some balancing for sure. I think the other piece is that when I look at job descriptions, I'm struck by how boring they are. So what I mean by this is that it's just a list of things that you do and what you accomplish, right? I think that what we need to do is look at job descriptions and have three categories. One is how does this, what problem, human problems does this job solve? Mm-hmm. So instead of just skills, start talking about the problems we need to be solved. Yeah. The second is what does this job make possible? What is it integral to creating and making happen? And then the third is what are the strengths that we need to do this meaningful work well? The problem is right now, it's just usually a list of tasks. Here's your required skills. But I think that we can be more purposeful about how we even talk about jobs and work.
Are there particular steps that job seekers you think can take or can change as a result of, you know, where our world is going, how, you know, unpredictable the next job is, and you kind of have to think a couple of jobs ahead instead of one.
I think one thing is that if you ask this question of yourself, what should I do with my life? Mm-hmm. You're going to get a very narrow step-by-step linear path in which possibilities narrow as you keep doing the next what, right? So as you specialize, your attention narrows, your possibilities narrow, and specialty is important. But instead of asking, what should I do with my life? You should be asking questions like, what kinds of problems do I want to solve? Right. What should my life do for others? Right. Because when you start thinking about broader contributions, then there becomes numerous industries or possibilities in which you might contribute in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, you might not get to be that technical job you thought you wanted in that path, but you may be able to use your strengths in other ways to solve other problems. So I think, you know, people should look beyond the job title and look more at the problems the job solves. And that, I think, opens people's possibilities. I get this all the time when I work, you know, when I teach like college seniors,
right,
where it's like, okay, here's my like 10 step plan, right? Of here's what I'm going to do. Here's my linear career path.
Right.
And then a global pandemic happens. And the problem with tying your identity to what you do and the skills you have to do it is when you no longer can do it, so too goes your sense of self. Yeah. Really hard to bring yourself off the mat. But if you can tie your identity to the problems you want to solve, the strengths you have to solve those problems, the broader impact you want to make, and find organizations and jobs in which you can make that impact through, it's a much more sustainable career perspective, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm completely with you, Zach. I mean, in fact, that's one of my biggest goals, probably my primary goal of All Out Coach. And I hope this discussion with you here inspires a lot of people to transgress differences between them. And then number two, to extend the boundaries of their abilities and their roles.
Mm, yeah, I love that.
Like, yeah, you know, I'm I myself, you know, I don't think I've scratched the surface of a lot of different abilities and different responsibilities in which, you know, I myself can step in the future, and that I constantly try to do something new and something different in every role that I've had in my life.
Mm.
You know, I come from the Republic of Georgia, very antique country full of history, you know, in the Caucasus Mountains. I was 10 years old when I came here, but I consider myself American, but I bring a more global perspective because of the experiences, the friendships that I have in many different countries. I speak, by the way, Italian also. I know you
mentioned Yep.
I speak Italian very fluently, and I go there very often. And, you know, one of my best friends is Italian, in Rome, who's also my mentor, who's had a lot of impact on my life and how I can stretch myself as well, by the way. So I've, you know, I often say that it's not really where you come from, what you look like, what you dress like, what you say, but it's what you do that makes you different. Like I often say that behavior is your number one brand. And you know, and that's why at the end of, you know, the pandemic, you mentioned the pandemic, right? I think that we need more humanists out there.
Yeah.
You know, humanists from the Renaissance. You know, the Renaissance, for some reason, when you think about the Renaissance, you know, four centuries ago, you don't have the same rate of innovation or the same kinds of complexity in art, in architecture, because the people who sponsored that, the Renaissance, right, the Medici family and everyone in, for the most part, right, who followed that movement had a different vision for what art should be, right? To build a community where knowledge was not a commodity, but knowledge was something that was practical, became practical. And that's why, you know, I'm often, when I reflect on the people that I become friends with or who I invite here on All Out Coach, they're able to integrate the different parts of life into their work, their business work. We're still in that need of, you know, innovation that is not just technology that's spiritless, to your point, you know, but that includes some kind of a human aspect, you know, and ways that we can apply all that technology well, because, you know, no technology can save a person who's rigid, an organization that's rigid. And it's, you know, it's like having a Ferrari or Lamborghini in your backyard and not knowing how to drive it or crashing it basically on purpose or something, just to show that you can do that, you know, and then you can buy another Ferrari.
I liken it to like, and I use this metaphor all the time, like you're painting a house and you just want to paint it this new color, but you don't scrape the old paint off underneath. Eventually the old paint peels through, right? That's how beliefs are. Yep. You know, we can put all this pretty paint on, but eventually beliefs win. And one of the things that I think that I want to say is that I think that we need to be better at coming to know each other and really taking an interest in each other and noticing each other. And, you know, being curious about each other's stories and perspectives, because that's also the knowledge that human beings have because of their stories is an underutilized technology.
Great point, Zach. In fact, if you look at my logo, All Out Coach, I didn't hire anyone to, I wanted it to be personal.
Yeah.
So I have a heart-shaped clock because I find that that's a deficit, you know, in the kind of world in which we live, where it's a luxury to really get to know each other because of how many notifications you get every single minute. So we actually let time rule us rather than ruling time, I believe. And that's what I want to give back and in meetings also. And that kind of is a segue to another question that I was curious about from your standpoint, because you deal with many corporations. How does facilitation of meetings, of business meetings, impact culture, the culture of people and how they behave with communicate with one another, particularly in this virtual world in which we live now? What are some observations that you've made?
Yeah, you have to see meetings for what they are, and they're rituals. You know, they're rituals that reaffirm beliefs, right? So if you get into your ritual and your ritual is to do updates,
Right.
I call them update fests. Like I want my people to be inspired. What's your update? Update, update, update. You go around, update, update, update. And then you don't talk about anything of strategic importance and you don't check in on the human beings that are in the meeting. And then you break. What kind of culture will that create? Well, it will create a very rigid transactional culture where there's a one-way transaction of information. Here's the information you need to know. I'm out. Right. And I see that all the time where meetings are transactional. They're not transformational. Yeah. So, a couple of ways, if we're talking about tactics to break right. that.
Yes, that would be great. Yeah.
Just implementing some moments at the beginning of a meeting where you can check in on the individual human beings right. who are at the meeting. Like just having someone go around and say, hey, what has your attention right now? What are the things you're thinking about? Or what kind of day have you had so far? Or, you know, one of my favorites is doing a red, yellow, green check-in. Red is kind of your offline, you're stressed. Yellow is, you know, you're there, but you're a little bit distracted. Green means you're totally present. Just go around and have people say, you know, where are you? Red, yellow, green today. Like just get a pulse of who's in the room, because when people feel like their presence and how they're coming into a room is honored, they're much more likely to engage. The other thing is spend some time in meetings, every meeting, talking about why the meeting exists, showing people that, like sharing stories of the work's impact, maintaining meaningfulness, asking people to tell a story of the past week of when they really felt like their work mattered right. to another person. Mm-hmm. Even just 3 to 5 minutes of that, research finds actually hearing a story of how your work benefits other people can result in 400% increase in motivation and productivity over 6 months, right? From Adam Grant at the Wharton School. So Optimize some of those practices to make sure meetings aren't just transactional and they're more transformational. It's like on social media, right? I mean, you know, those people that just dump a post out there and you comment on it, they never comment again, right? Those people don't get much engagement long-term, right? It's called vanity posting, and meetings that are just transactional updates are vanity meetings, really.
Yeah.
Just having the meeting to say we're having a meeting.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. I thank you for the tips. No, I appreciate the tips, the red, the kind of the color coding, the priorities and everything like that. I think that's a great advice. Time, but just have a follow-up, question on that. What role do you think time plays in these meetings? Because some of my most memorable meetings that I've ever attended or been a part of, Zach, were ones where meetings ran over, but people were able to exchange, have a free flow of exchange, and they were brainstorming and they were being transformational, to your point, not transactional, right? I think what I've noticed is there's a cultural difference, and it's a global kind of, I provide more of a global perspective on this because I've been a part of companies that have, let's say, both a United States component and an ex-US, right? Mm. And they handle meetings very differently. And it's clear even to anyone, right? Where I think that many of us in the United States, for example, we respect time so much where time is money, but time is not money because you can't give
time back.
Yeah. But, we tend to worry and hurry people and rush people to speak freely to make sure that we, make that one time because we have a next meeting coming up, right?
Yep.
But at the expense of really maybe not scheduling our day well, we may be actually... We may be diminishing the value of this meeting, and maybe it may be coming at the expense of the value and the transformation of the current meeting in which we are. So we tend to not get to know each other as well through meetings. We tend to let things pass, let somebody make one kind of comment that may be misinterpreted by someone without having a moderator, and just to keep the culture kind of the status quo, right? We let that go. That continues to resurface. And I've seen this happen many times. And that blows up at some point. you know, because you don't facilitate meetings as a leader of that meeting, as a sponsor of that meeting, I think, you know, and some meetings, I think, need to have something accomplished, you know, at least one thing accomplished, or one, or at least have a dialogue, an ongoing dialogue, whether or not you end that meeting on time or not. Those have been some of the most memorable meetings. And so that's why I asked that question, you know, in terms of how do we perceive time? Is it, you know, as in meetings? So do we need to schedule our days better? Maybe we need to, I don't know, reduce virtual meetings to the back-to-back Zooms that we have, and give somebody, just give one meaningful relationship at a time. That's actually my tagline, Zach, on LinkedIn. Energy, excitement, and one meaningful relationship at a time.
That's awesome. So I think
the reason I asked
you. Can I make one comment on what you just said? I think what you're talking about is, when I look at work teams, an inordinate amount of time is spent on doing things together.
Right.
And not on ways of being with each other. So when you focus on just doing things with a team without cultivating ways of being with a team.
And the purpose that you talk about.
Right. And how you communicate with one another, and why you're doing the work, and how to come to know one another, that anytime you focus on ways of doing without ways of being, you end up leaving a mess usually. So I think probably what you're experiencing when you are talking about these meetings that were really fruitful is that the team learned how to be with one another.
Yeah. They were in that moment and they were, yeah.
And that takes time, but the doing becomes better when we know who we are together. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that goes back to the first part of the conversation, which is around the importance of culture. Culture is, if you think about performance of what do? Culture is, who are we being when we do what we do? Who are we being, and who are we becoming? And that is inevitably linked to the quality of what you do, is who you are.
Yeah, great point. What are the consequences of having a purpose and no purpose at work? So following the advice that you give a lot of these companies, right? So what do they have to gain, right? After hiring Zach, right? And you teach them how to have better relationships, stronger, deeper relationships, and have purpose. I'd like to ask you to speak about that, you know, a little bit.
So what are the consequences of someone not having purpose at work? Well, it's very easy for nothing to matter to someone who doesn't believe that they matter, right? It goes down to mattering. I mean, people at every level have the desire to feel significance. And when you don't feel significance, you tend to feel invisible. And, you know, I was just looking at some recent surveys that find up to 43% of people in US companies in a large sample report feeling invisible, not even seen, right? And we know that invisibility leads to desperation and despair. And while it may be tempting to say, well, you know, you can just go and put in your time and you don't need to feel like you matter at work, inevitably, how you make meaning at work is how you make meaning in your life. And so if you spend 8 hours of your day in despair, who are you going to be as a family member, as someone in society, right? So there's that element of it from a human public health perspective. I think the widespread despair we see is actually a direct result of a lack of meaningfulness in work. And so the second piece, though, of that is, think about what you do care about. Like, think about the things you need to get done as an organization to be able to have profit, to be able to have a purpose and deliver that purpose. Mm-hmm. And motivation, what we know is that motivation is a direct result of people knowing the significance of what they do, knowing how what they do makes something else possible, and they can use their strengths to do it. So again, if people don't have those leading indicators of motivation, you can't expect them to be motivated. So I say that that's what I focus on, like the leading indicators of performance and well-being, which is purpose and meaningfulness. And it's been that way for centuries. I'm not saying anything new. Simon Sinek is not saying anything new, Right. I mean, these are very old 15th yep. century ideas.
Of course, we all learn from. Yeah.
Yes. So I think that sometimes it's just about going back to thinking about the origins of work, and all work was purposeful pre-second industrial revolution. Like if I was a shoemaker, I made shoes so my neighbor could have shoes. Mm-hmm. If I was a farmer, I made sure to grow crops so my community could eat. And I think this return to purposeful work is just a return to people wanting to see the impact of what they're doing. It's a very primitive human desire to work purposefully.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mentor a lot, and you know, I know a lot of talented individuals, researchers, scientists who love the nature of their job, right? They love the process and what they do, but they do not know the impact of their work.
Yeah.
And they complain to me and you know, they, and it's very real. The statistics you just talked about, and you know, your whole focus of your work and research is extremely real. It's, you know, and that's why I'm very excited to just have some of your time here. Because I've spoken to coaches, award-winning CEOs in my industry, for example.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, in the pharmaceutical industry. And they've interviewed thousands of executives, you know, in this industry that is doing some incredible work, right? We're bringing vaccines but we do not often address a lot of the untold, you know, dynamics in leadership that he has uncovered and he has shared with me candidly, where most of the leadership is just not happy themselves. They're just not happy right now. You know, they're not, a lot of them are not happy, and they do not know their own impact. So how do you expect them to share the energy that I think is missing in a lot of talented individuals who don't know their impact? And until we really address those issues, we cannot move forward, I believe. So it's not that, and many people who are, you know, in my industry, in my colleagues, I think they know me, and they know the reputation that I've been able to build over time, and what I've endured, and what I think I've been valuable to some people, some of my colleagues, you at least, I would hope.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's not that I am diminishing the value of my industry or my colleagues, but I think we can't move forward until we stop being politically correct and start being more globally correct. You know, globally conscious, meaning what is the impact of what I'm doing, not only to my colleague here and to my town and my you know, county, but to others, because you know the lines between countries are now blurred, you know, in my industry, right, everywhere, you know, and we need to stop patting ourselves on the back like Boeing was doing, right? Until you uncovered, because you don't need to have a tragedy that resurfaces until you address it. And that's what I'm trying to move and to change, you know, in my industry, one conversation like this at a time, you know,
yep. Zach.
So yeah, I think you bring up a lot of great points, and you know, I've also seen some research from Gallup, you know, that shows that I think over 80%, almost like 88 to, or even in 90% range of top of Fortune 500 companies admit that they don't hire the right person, mm-hmm. and that they don't provide enough opportunities for them to develop themselves either. You know, because it's not something that probably they see as revenue generating, or in the volatile world that we have. But also, speaking of research, I would love to ask you your opinion on the TOMO score that I read about in the Harvard Business Review article. This total motivational score that studied over 20,000 different employees, and that was able to narrow down the different motivational factors into a spectrum of 6 that range from those that predict high job fulfillment down to ones that predict low fulfillment, right? And they start with play, where somebody is just working because they just like the process of it. They know, you know, they want to save lives. They know that they want to do no harm. They want to be a physician, right? Then you have play, then purpose. They have some kind of purpose for which they are doing their job. They're teaching because they want to educate the next generation. And the third is potential. They're teaching because they have the potential to be promoted sometime and to become a superintendent. And then you have others, right? Like emotional pressures, economic pressures, and inertia. When you just don't know, when you wake up, to your point earlier, you wake up and you don't know why you're going to work. You don't know your purpose. And apparently these six are consolidated into a questionnaire, easy questionnaire. And they built these linear regression models, and companies like Trader Joe's and Southwest Airlines came up very high. And it's something that I actually have thought about introducing to my company where I work right now as well. But I just wanted to see, is there a particular metric of purpose or job fulfillment that you like to support or use?
Yeah, what I like about the TOMO is that it focuses on leading indicators of engagement and motivation. It's so tempting to, as a leader, to say, I want my people to be motivated. But motivation is a lagging indicator. Engagement is a lagging indicator. Satisfaction is a lagging indicator. When those three things are happening, engagement, motivation, satisfaction, that's what fulfillment is. But those are measuring something that already happened. What's great about the TOMO is you're starting to get a pulse on and invest in leading indicators of those things. Yep. Meaningfulness. Psychological safety is one that's not on there, but we know adds to motivation, which is not experiencing fear in the work, being able to speak up, having high quality connections and relationships with other people. So I think anytime you can look at the leading indicators and start training leaders to be able to cultivate those things, and then also to keep a regular pulse on those things, I think it's powerful. You should not be doing a once a year assessment and think you know your culture. I'll say that. Your leaders should have the skills to uncover the pulse of their teams daily, weekly, from these things. What I like using is I pull from a variety of different positive psychology research. And you know, the first is, and I mentioned this earlier, so it'd be good to come full circle to this, but do people experience their work as meaningful? So do they know the significance of their work? Do they know how their work contributes to a bigger whole? The second is emotions, measuring emotions. So emotions in organizations can be contagious. It's this phenomenon called emotional contagion. That when somebody experiences a negative emotion, up to three people around them can mirror that emotion. So creating an experiences that cultivate gratitude, joy, hope, resilience, optimism, those are some really important emotions people need to feel and work. The second is connected, right? Are people able to create relationships that people help them with their tasks? They can play. There's some humor there. There's trust in the relationships. And then the final is that fear-free component, the psychological safety component. And I combine measures from all of those to create a comprehensive measure of a pulse of those things. And I should also say that it's important that those leading indicators take place in a context of high standards. So this is something that people want to differentiate. They think that we can have the high standards, high expectations, or we can focus on this culture leading indicators of motivation. But if you have all of this stuff without high standards, you just have a really feel good place to be. But I think you need both. You need to have high performance standards, and you need to cultivate an environment that enables those standards to be met. And that's when, again, the magic happens. But I've said this before, a recipe for workplace misery is having high expectations and not a culture that facilitates the energy needed to meet those expectations.
So it sounds like you believe that it's possible to have metrics and to have a positive culture.
Absolutely.
Because the reason I kind of phrase that way is because I know a lot of people, a lot of very intelligent people who detest metrics. When they hear the word metrics, you just lose their attention, or they complain about metrics. But at the same time, without some sense of, you know, your progression, your direction, you can't really be self-aware either, right? So can metrics then, as a follow-up question, do you believe that metrics can be designed in a way that can foster collaboration rather than competition?
Yeah, I would say that if they're they're probably using metrics and measuring things that don't matter, right. like really matter. Yeah, I think when I think about metrics, like from a culture perspective, if you're measuring the degree to which someone feels like they can give new ideas without being retaliated against, that's a developmental metric. You know, that's a, or if you're measuring the ability to for someone to create trusting relationships with other people, those are the metrics that matter, in my opinion.
Research supports that.
Yeah. So own, right. Right. Yep. So I would make sure that the metrics are measuring, again, those leading indicators of all of the things you want. Most people like get an engagement score.
Right.
Doesn't all an engagement score tells you is the level of engagement when people filled out a survey.
Right.
In that snapshot in time. I mean, it gives you some nice data like overview, but really to facilitate culture, most of the top organizations are doing regular, if not daily, pulse assessments with their teams.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of metrics, then you have the reward structure, right? So where have to kind of tie some kind of rewards and recognitions, monetary, non-monetary recognitions, to be able to best reflect those metrics that can help people be engaged and collaborate and perform in the future, right? So unfortunately, I think much too often, many companies do not tell very transparently about the metrics they use, how they're going to be used, and how they're going to be used to rank, let's say, different sales reps from each other. But sales may not be such a good example because with them, it's more of a tangible kind of, it's something that's tangible. Whereas in other kind of functions, I don't know, in research and scientific research and in the medical function and pharmaceutical industry, not very often you're told about the metrics towards the end of the year, sometime or in the middle of the year, as a lagging kind of measure. You know, it's not a leading indicator. You don't know, and you're never really clear about how it is that you're recognized, and when you put the technology aspect into it and analytics that are used in a way that really is not relevant to your role, you have a lot of people who are frustrated in the medical division, you know, who are high performers nevertheless. And then you have some people who are high performers who have horrible culture, who in some organizations continue to be rewarded, right? Despite these metrics that are unclear, that are nebulous. So I think the lesson to learn here is the leading indicators, communicating them regularly and frequently based on what Zach has taught us here. And, you know, I completely agree with you. In fact, I've dedicated an article to it. I may have shared it with you on LinkedIn to study metrics more often. But I think even discussing these, you know, when you talk to some of the executives, they don't place as much value on recognition, on awards. They feel like that's a competition. Whereas I actually have a different perspective. It's an appreciation of people's time, their efforts, and their presence. And it's something that other people can use as an example. When you have somebody who's recognized, whether it's a monetary or non-monetary recognition, it sets an example to others. It's just a matter of what system you use to make that distinction. That can maybe.
And you got to be careful with rewards, because rewards are powerful in the sense of what you reward will inevitably be who you become. Mm-hmm. I once had a sales manager come to me and say, "Zach, my people don't collaborate." And I said, "Okay, let me just look at your, show me your incentive structure." And she was incentivizing everybody for self-serving goals and individual sales numbers. And so if you reward people for individual sales, they're not going to be a collaborative team, right? I mean, like if you reward people for looking after themselves, they're not going to look after other people.
Yes.
And at the same time, what if you did something like rewarded people for helping other people close a deal or for team selling, right? Exactly. Those are the things that when you start rewarding for collaboration, I would venture to guess and I would hypothesize that your sales will go up and people will feel better about the work. So that's my one warning, is that make sure that you're ready to handle the implications of what you're rewarding for.
Mm-hmm.
And how are your rewards complicit in creating the conditions you say you want to improve in your culture?
I formed a company with that objective, bridging that gap between metrics and organizational leadership, and management consulting company called Amadea Pharma. Zach, I want to finish with the last couple of questions. And the first one is really, what are some innovative practices that you've seen? What are some of the most innovative, let's say, best practices that you've seen in companies that have been able to transform and improve the sense of purpose and belonging among their employees?
Yeah, a couple of things that I've been seeing recently, especially in this pandemic with the rise of remote work, is a lot of really great things that probably should have been done when people were in person are being done. One of the things is doing a morning and afternoon assessment where employees can come in the morning and they answer questions like, who can you help today? In what ways is what you're going to do today going to have an impact? And it's just like a 2 to 3 question little, and people use it on Slack or some other channel, right? And then at the end of the day, like I know Chick-fil-A, for example, does a questionnaire for their employees at the end of the shift is, which team member did you help today and how did you help them?
Wow.
And it's just little, right? It takes 5 minutes, but the questions we ask each other determine the answers we get. And questions enable us to direct people's attention. So this is a really cool thing that I've seen. So I think anytime you can set people's mindset before and after a day as a team, if you have a Slack channel or some sort of other channel, that's a great technique that I've seen come out to really get micro about culture. And it's really exciting. I would say on a bigger scale, one of the best examples of this is when your culture becomes a code that has teeth to it. So I've done some work with a dealer for Caterpillar, the big, large equipment manufacturer, big yellow trucks, you know, I tell my six-year-old. And they have a code of conduct that governs all stakeholders. So dealers, customers, anybody. And you can report violations of this code of conduct up through a council. And what's really cool about this is that the conduct is directly related to their values. So people, the conduct is all related to behaviors that enact the values. And so not only have they stated their values, they've stated specific behaviors that show how people enact those values. And then they've created a formal accountability mechanism for anybody who interacts with the company to be accountable for. And the result is one owner of a dealer I was working with for Caterpillar said that, you know, we don't fire people based on performance. We only let people go based on values misalignment. Because what they believe is that if you're aligning with the values, this is very similar to Southwest Airlines, by the way, if you're acting in alignment with the values, performance inevitably follows.
Yeah.
So if you're doing any of this work, get into it and make sure it seeps through into your reward structure, into an accountability structure where people are as robustly held to a standard of how to be with each other as they are what they do or their performance.
Great, great examples there, Zach. I believe that culture is character times behavior. And
Yeah.
You know, that's my formula at All Out Coach for culture. And I think that your examples there, they speak to the fact that in practicality, in the real world, what you have, those initiatives, I think ultimately end up leading to people, employees who behave in their character rather than outside of their character, where you don't have people who are honest, but who are all of a sudden starting to behave unethically or do not express their passion at work, right? Where they're aligned, their character is aligned with their behavior also. You know, I think that's what all of those initiatives probably end up leading to. You know, we've concentrated on everyone else here. A lot of great organizations are experiencing.
Yep.
But my last question, Zach, is what are some activities in which you escape, in which you find purpose yourself, just to get, for us to get to know Zach Mercurio?
I love being outside. So I do a lot of biking and hiking. I live in Colorado, and so I love being outside. I also love reading. I mean, one of my favorite, I think writing can expand the bounds of understanding. Like we have a limited amount of understanding. Like our understanding of others is really about who we're in contact with on a daily basis. And really that's a limited resource. But one of the things that I love reading the international section of the New York Times because every day, because I'm able to like be in the lives of other people in other cultures. And I think doing that every day for years, I still get the physical paper. I read the international section has allowed me to realize how much I don't understand, but allows me to really get transported into other people's lives. So spending a lot of time outside, spending a lot of time reading, and the reason why I like the newspaper still is because an algorithm doesn't tell me what I should be interested in. And I think that letting natural curiosity sort of take over by finding different headlines, you know, and I would say to everybody listening, find a way to escape the algorithm and let your curiosity be cultivated in some way. For me, it's reading the international section. For you, it might be something else, but
yeah. No, I love hardcover books too.
Yeah, but that's
Kindle, but I want to physically, you know, I have a tactile person and
And do things like the other thing that helps me is when I kind of forced myself to do things I'm not interested in right away. Yeah. So like if I start reading an article, I will make myself read the whole thing. Right. And I think that what it does is it helps you get an understanding of why you're not interested in something, but usually it's because we don't have the whole story or it's because of our biases. So
yeah,
I guess that's not necessarily what you were looking for, but that's what I do for fun. So
no, it is. No, thank you so much, Zach, for your time.
Yeah.
Everyone go to ZachMercurio.com. As you can see here and you can hear, we have a bright leader here who can transform people, companies, and careers. So I look forward to having you again on my show, Zach, when you will have some new research as well, because I know you have a lot of accomplishments, recognitions based on the research that you're doing. I wish you good luck with the research you do this year and have a great productive year ahead. Zach, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.